the Million Dollar Mortgage Experience Podcast.
All right, welcome to today's podcast. We're here with Logan Motashami. He's an expert on the U.S. economy and real estate market. As a lead analyst for Housing Wire, he translates complex data into financial truth for housing economics. Welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Yes, I got you here in the studio. I'm stoked. Last time we were on Zoom, which was cool, but it's always better in person.
Yeah, it's always better in person.
Yeah, so you gave us kind of a history before in our last podcast with you about your kind of your story on how you got into the market. You were a loan officer for a while. You had, I think, a mortgage company, and then now you just do only data analytics and you've keyboard warrior stuff with people on Twitter.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey because my whole game plan was I was going to be a high school basketball coach and teach history. You know, that was my whole thing. And then got into the stock market in the 1990s and then got into the mortgage industry with my father, and the money was a lot better. I was like, okay, starting salary for a teacher was like $26,000 back then. I was like, okay, that's not going to work. And then just did mortgages. But about 2010, a financial website, Benzinga.com, actually said, would you like to, you know, write politic economics for us? I was like, no, that's not me. But I could talk about real estate economics. So that led to a few articles. I started my own blog. So it was more or less about kind of just giving a commentary about the state of housing. Wasn't designed to do anything. But as time went on, I realized, wait a second, there's a lot of bad information out there.
It really is.
And I was like, maybe we should do this in a more data analytical way as an analyst, but always talk about the economic cycle first and housing. So give people something real to use. So about 2015, I changed everything, started to incorporate models and everything just to be a little bit more prolific. And, you know, come toward end of 2019, Housing Wire said, do you want to write for us maybe one or two articles? I said, sure. COVID-19 happened, wrote a crazy COVID-19 recovery model on April 7, 2020 that Housing Wire said, I don't know if we should publish this. Do you really think we're going to recover this year? I said, oh yeah, this is going to happen. That's going to happen. This is on this date and everything. And then well, before the year's out, we're good. So then I was actually going to stop writing. I was going to do one economic cycle and pick a point in 2020 to 2024 to retire, and then didn't do something else. And then the forbearance crash bros came. So it was like the summer of 2020. I was like, these people are still crazy. It doesn't matter. It's like the market's already recovered and they're never going to stop. So then I thought, I can't ever stop this, can I? You know,
you got sucked into a different side of the business.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm going to have to do this. And so it was like, now I'm fully in. And like early 2020, I retired from the mortgage industry and I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I'm 100% committed.
Yep.
And then let's go with it. So it's too much fun. It's just way too much fun for one person to have. I feel like an NFL star. Like, you know, they're actually paying me to do this, you know.
That's awesome. Well, you seem to be having fun. Mm-hmm. When I listen to your podcast, if you're listening now, definitely check out the Housing Wire podcast. It's great, but you always seem to be having fun.
Yeah. It's way too much fun for one person to have. And when all you do is look at economic data 24/7, and then you could have the ability to talk about it. And then my thing is I love to debate about it.
Yeah.
Like I just like live debating has always been my strength, and I've never had an avenue to kind of do that in.
And do you ever go live on like social media and try to get people to?
I on Twitter, I challenge everyone to live debates. And so far I got two stock traders to take my bait, and we did a webinar on it and everything. And so my whole thing is that doing this for the last 13 years and having the receipts and the record, and I was like, the next 10 years, I'm going to debate everyone I'm going to take as many people on live debates and just absolutely destroy as many people and have a collection of trophies because, they're not economists. They're not data analysts. They're just, you know, a lot of them are just trolling for doom click, you know, kind of thing. So, it gives me motivation. It's like an athlete. I always tell people like, think of me as a strong safety. And I see an overrated tight end coming down the middle. I know he talks a lot, but if I can knock him on his ass in front of everyone, he's not coming back in the middle anymore, but everyone gets to see. So it's kind of like every single day when I get up, that's the kind of attitude I have. And you got to be focused. You got to be disciplined. You got to track all economic data, but you got to be able to tell the story that people could understand,
yep.
you know, in a way that, you know, then that's how you defeat a troll arc army. You teach people, you know, how to read economic data, and then they do the work for you a lot of times.
Well, you probably are disappointing some people because they're like, I can't wait for the housing crash or the bubble to burst. And then I'm going to buy and I'm going to buy cheap. And you guys are all going to be fools because you paid this high price. And what is your current economic update on the housing health?
So I always say the housing market is savagely unhealthy because it doesn't have the ability to have these like major inventory increases like it did, you know, in 2005, 6, 7, and 8. And that's a lot of my work is showing people how credit channels, everything changed in the US economy after 2010. Qualified mortgage just right. changed everything. So everybody keeps on thinking that, okay, at some point, inventory is going to skyrocket, foreclosures. Sure. And it's just not that kind of marketplace. And, you know, our family's been in banking since the late 1950s. So this is kind of what we do. And I don't think people understand like how well homeowners are off. And like traditionally, it's like, do people sell to be homeless? No. I mean, if you had a family, kids, the cops takes your kids away, you know. So right. you get this fixed 30-year payment. Your wages rise every year. Your total housing cost gets less. Unlike that period where you had a lot of short-term fixed debt. And when that recast, like Canada right now, Canada, people are waking up in Canada, their mortgage payment doubled. You know, so
they have arms.
Yeah, right? They have arms and they're trying to do 90-year loan modifications. Jeez. Right. So it's just like Canada, UK, Australia, Norway, all these countries are tied to short-term debt. We have this 30-year fixed product. And it doesn't allow sales to like boom like it did during the housing. I would say you can never have a credit sales boom ever again. But man, the homeowners are going to look good, especially yeah. now that, you know, I think one of the things that people don't understand is from 1985 to 2007, people lived in their homes 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. After 2008, it's 11 to 13 years, depending on really who you listen to. Some parts of the country, especially like in California, it's 15 to 18 years. I've lived in my house, it's going to be 20 years this April. And all of our wages are so much higher than when we first got, you know, the home. And then we have 3 refinancing waves.
Sure.
So
the rates are way, if so you locked in, it's so cheap.
The whole housing cost is so low and people don't know that. And they just think like people are just going to give that up, you know? So it's not the case. My job is to show why. That's the key.
Do you think there's anything that could happen apart from like a, you know, bunch of people passing away, but that could create a shift in that housing.
A job loss recession will create new listings data to grow faster yeah. just because. But then again, when that happens, mortgage rates come down. So it's, I would say it's like you have 157 million people working. Imagine that first 3-4 months where you have a couple hundred thousand jobs being lost, but rates are going to go down. So that 157 million people working is that I always say my army's bigger than yours. This is what happened in COVID. COVID, a lot of my smart economic friends were like, Logan, how can you say demand's going to come back? There's 20 to 30 million people unemployed, 5 million in forbearance. And I always go, oh, that's cute. Look at this army behind me. I have 133 million people still working and getting paid with 3% mortgage rates out there. Demand's going to come right back. You know, as soon as they're comfortable to live, right? They're not worried. They're not afraid of dying. Just go live. It'll be back. It came back in 6-7 weeks.
Yep.
Like the demand was just there. So because home sales are so low right now, it doesn't take much to move the needle, but it does need lower rates. So I think that's whenever the job loss recession happens, that's going to be the next stage of the work. Can this massive U.S. workforce with lower rates offset, you know, the couple hundred thousand homeowners that are going to lose their jobs in the first year, because the majority of those that are unemployed in every recession are those who didn't finish high school, renter financial profile. So we'll cross that bridge when we get there, but that is something that can change the 30-year fix, you know, the dominating factor of people being able to shelter themselves, not only from inflation, but from an aggressive Federal Reserve as well.
What about AI? So AI has a ton of potential to take people out of jobs, right? To take over jobs, disrupt jobs. Now we're seeing this new one, I think it's Sora or something like that, which is like making video. You just type in whatever it is. And so like video people who are making videos potentially could be out of job, coders. What do you think AI is going to do to the job market?
I mean, for the last 120 years, I would say every decade, there's always some new technology that's supposed to take away all the jobs.
Yep. Tractor.
And yeah, you know, the horses, you know, gin. So what they don't talk about is the jobs that get created with new technology.
Right.
You know, medical device, you know, wasn't an industry 50, 60 years now. It's a booming industry. So there are always going to be sectors where jobs will be lost, but there's always going to be a factor where people need labor for the new technology as well. And whatever goes into that tech, the chips, you know, NVIDIA is doing unbelievably good, you know. So it's not a 100% negative like people think. And I always say that we have 9 million job openings.
Yeah.
And the baby boomers are, you know, going away.
Retiring, going away.
So they're going away. So guess what? Population growth isn't massive here in America with a lot of mature economies. So I'm not worried about all the jobs going away. I'm actually more concerned over time about demographics, you know, what's happening in Japan and China and what's happening in Europe. You know, eventually
we're having less kids.
Eventually demographics gets us all, but I'm not kind of worried about the job market in the sense of AI being the job. There's industries that are going to get hit right away. But we're not there yet in terms of technology. I mean, I wish productivity was higher in America, but you know, it's just, there's limits to what we can do on productivity and doing more with less people.
So what about the builders? They're not building, right? They're not, I mean, there's little trick, like small pockets, but you know, probably the biggest time in my career was during, you know, 01 to 07 was a massive time in my career. And it was just, there's just tons of houses being built. Did they just get slapped too hard that they don't want to come back? Or
I would say this. I actually don't agree with my fellow economist friends who say that the builders underbuilt in the last decade, because I always focus people on the last decade had the weakest new home sales cycle ever. I mean, new home sales were just going down on 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2018. Missed sales estimates. Yep. So they're just going to build based on their demand curve. They're never going to put their heads down and basically go there and outdo everyone else. That goes against their profit margins.
Right.
So I think that's the key that people have to understand. You only build on what you can sell. And the builders have managed that, and they manage it very well. This is where it gets them out of trouble, right? They're not just going to put their head down and build homes without the contract buyer in there. You could have some spec homes, but nothing too dramatic.
To your point of, you know, the they actually are building, I guess it's just like, you know, is there just less of a demand to be able to buy these new homes, or what do you think?
Well, right now the builders have a very unique advantage. There's not a lot of active inventory in the existing home sales market. That's their main competition. Right. And the existing home sale market has higher rates. So the builder's like, hey, everyone,
yeah, guess what? Buy the rate down.
You could have a sub 6% mortgage rate here. You know, yeah, you got to pay up a little bit more than that cheaper house, but you got a sub 6% mortgage and it's a brand new house. And they are absolutely milking that as much as they can. And they need to, because they have a big backlog of homes they have to work through. So single family permits are still rising in America. The apartment boom is over.
Yeah.
You know, that ended last year. So we see the apartment permits actually starting to fall noticeably. In fact, you know, in a few months, it'll be before the COVID-19 lows. So that is over. But single family permits are going. One of the reasons why we're not in a recession is that every single recession in America has residential construction workers falling into the recession because rates go up. Housing leads the recession, leads the recovery. Well, the builders decided, hey, our profit margins are good. We'll pay down rates. We'll keep people employed. We'll still sell these homes. So for now, that's working. I think a lot of the missed recession calls in 2022 to 2023 was that. Kind of toward the end of 2022, rates started to fall, builders paid down rates, they got people to buy homes, and they kept those people employed. The apartment boom is over. That marketplace is going to lose employment once those backlogs are worked through.
So I've seen some rents come down on apartments. I mean, we have a condo that came up for rent. I thought it was going to, you know, be higher this next time around, and we had to cut it because it's in Nashville, and there's all these people, all these brand new condos that are going out to market. And so there's just a massive supply in that particular, in that area. So Are you seeing that also with kind of what you said with the apartments? Like the rents are coming down
a little bit? Yeah, there are more units under construction or have not finished or even started yet that are 5-unit apartments. So I would say those, the ones that haven't started, not sure if those are even going to ever start. But there's a huge backlog on top of the fact that supply is growing. And also wage growth is cooling down, right? Mm-hmm. So it's harder and harder to raise rents in that environment. So supply is coming. You know, the laws of supply and demand, right? More supply coming.
Yeah, bring the price down.
Yeah, rents are going to come down. Now, major rental deflation is not a thing in America because most people are working. And single family rents are holding up well. Okay. I think that's been stable for the last 6 months. But the apartment, especially Nashville, is one of them. You see 1, 2, 3 free rents for the first month and coming in. So definitely the supply is kicking in there. And, you know, that's one of the reasons to have an apartment boom, right? Yeah. You know, that story ended last year. So you're probably not going to see permits grow until maybe mid to late 2025 or early 2026. They've got to work off of the supply that's coming in and see where rents go.
Got it. So the billion-dollar question is, when is the Fed going to cut rates? Do you have a crystal ball somewhere down there?
I'm not a Fed pivot person. So when you're not a Fed pivot person, you got to think, well, if you're not a Fed pivot, why would they cut rates? Well, the reality is that the Fed was forecasting a recession last year. They counted on it. You know, they said, okay, we'll raise short-term rates so high, so fast that the labor market will have a mild recession and we'll handle that later. The reality is not only did that not happen, growth went above trend, which is something they didn't think could happen. The stock market recovered, which they didn't think could happen. And the labor data stayed solid. So I'm going to be in the 3 rate cut camp. And even with 3 rate cuts, they're actually still restrictive policy because the growth rate of inflation has fallen faster than they thought. Whether it's May or June, 3 rate cuts will come. But if the labor data starts to get weaker, then you could see more aggressive rate cuts. But in that sense, also the bond market will start to go down. Mortgage rates will go down with it.
All right. So we still are going to get some rate cuts.
Yeah, we're still going to get rate cuts.
May, June, so a little ways off.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people said, oh, the recent PPI inflation number, it's really exciting. I said, it's basically lower in a 12-month now than it was in the previous decade when we have zero interest rate policy. So the PCE inflation is where the Federal Reserve tracks. And it has one handles on 3 to 6 month inflation data, 2 handles on. So the global pandemic inflationary story is done. That's pretty much over with. So it depends on how restrictive the Fed wants to be. To me, I've always said that they would prefer the labor market to get softer because of this fear of the 1970s entrenched inflation. So we're not there yet on the jobless claims data. That's my key data line. So that's why I can't be like a 5-6 rate cut person. Goldman Sachs still thinks there'll be 5 rate cuts, but the Fed just is, like I always say, they're going to be so old and slow here. Mm-hmm. It's going to surprise everyone, especially with all the progress that is made with inflation. You know, people would have thought, okay, they would have been so easily to push for rate cuts, but it's frustrated a lot of people.
So how'd the Fed get it so wrong? Because they, like you said, right? They thought it was going to happen, but it didn't. They thought their policy was going to change.
I think if you're running a 1970s inflation model, not a pandemic, you're going to be wrong. You're going to be terribly wrong because the 1970s was unbelievable labor force growth. Housing was booming back then. We had an oil shock. That inflation is different. Here, the history of global pandemics, very inflationary early on, and the disinflation happens. If they didn't hike the last 1.5 times, the data would have looked the same, right? So they just assumed that the economy couldn't grow at trend. They assumed the labor market would get softer and stocks could, everything happened, right? Everything they thought couldn't happen actually happened. So wrong model for the wrong time. I think that's part of the problem. They don't feel comfortable. They're so worried about the 70s and they go, oh my God, unemployment rate's so low. What if housing takes off again? And this is why they're kind of kicking and screaming. That's why toward the end of 2022, I came up with the old and slow kind of mindset, because they changed. They were like 100% on for the soft landing. And somewhere toward the end of 2022, they said, okay, we just have to keep on hiking. Doesn't matter what happens. And we have to be more restrictive. And this is where we are, right? We're at the rate cut phase. Just depends on how many we get each year now.
Odds at potentially rate hikes?
No, rate hikes. I mean, a rate hike would have to be rents taking off again and wage growth taking off again. You know, the Fed always tracks these inflationary, their inflation data are almost being hit. Wage growth is slowing down. To even talk about rate hikes with everything now, you really need a reacceleration of inflation and the economy to grow above trend, to stay above trend.
I guess it could happen if there was another pandemic.
Well, then there's a pandemic, yeah. And then, you know, obviously I think people will react differently to pandemics now.
Was there data on the previous pandemic? Like
global pandemic? Yeah, like, yeah. You know,
was that 1917?
Yeah, I always, you know, we look at 1918 and 1920, and we look at, you know, rental inflation was big. Right, but all pandemics, just because supply chains don't work, nothing works normal. So
you can't get anything. So people, need this.
It's amount to war in a sense. War is very inflationary, right? You know, World War II. You know, people, countries had to ration things. So if you look at it in that point, that's where you get inflation, right? There's only so much when gas prices go up and certain gas stations,
right?
You know, they don't have enough gasoline. They kind of hoard. They raised the price just to keep it. So pandemics are very, very inflationary early on, and then the disinflation happens. So it's not shocking what's happening to rent now. That's the same thing happened, you know, in 1918 and going up to the 1920s.
Yeah. So it does seem like the Fed doesn't talk about housing in a positive light.
Yes. And I think this is probably one of the more frustrating things, because you know, that at first they say housing reset, or how housing is in a bubble, or you know, we need the housing market to go down. Okay, so the inflation rates are so high, but now with the inflation growth rate slowing, they're like, why won't the Fed ever say anything like, we want to help the housing market? Well, if you're running a 70s models, people forget this. The 70s, housing was booming.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it was and
rates were high, but
I mean, the labor force growth was, you know, unbelievable. So people needed shelter. So I think in the back of their mind, they're just not comfortable of like the only thing in our, we have this economy that's expanding, but there's one data line that is at great recession lows, you know, it's like, then it's the housing market. Existing home sales are running up right at 4 million. So to me, I think that's the fear. I believe that's the fear about, you know, if housing starts to go up again, pretty much everyone's recession theory goes out the door, because, you know, housing leads the economy. They kind of just want to stay away from that. Just the fear of reacceleration inflation, which they don't really need to fear in this case. Without the global pandemic, you know, the inflation data would have looked the same. I mean, the 21st century, it's really hard to get core inflation above 2%. And that's with zero interest rate policy, QE1, QE2, QE3, balance sheet expansion. Couldn't get it, couldn't get core inflation to stay up. So I think so much of that is also rent too, and supplies coming in. So it's hard to like reverse the rate cut policy or the stance and start raising rates again.
So what about, you know, kind of always in the back of my mind, there's this thought of like, there could be a stock market crash, right? Like, you know, growing up, you know, seeing the different times it's happened where you like, you look at the TV and it's all dropping and everyone's freaking out, right? Or there's some event, there's some black swan event. And it hasn't happened. I mean, obviously COVID was a black swan event, but what are the odds, do you think, you know, because the stock market's been continuing to go up. What do you think the odds are we'll have one of those moments where,
when you have panic on
Wall Street?
When you have a recession, right, earnings come down. So, you know, the forecast for companies' earnings comes down and stocks go down, right? That's pretty much how economic cycles work. So we used to have a lot more volatility in the previous decade. I think we had like almost three times where we had almost a bear market during the longest economic and job expansion. So I think this is just the economy expanded. Nobody was ready for that. And people are playing catch up, you know, because if you're a Wall Street guy, if you're bearish when, you know, everyone's bearish, it's okay. When you're bearish and everyone else is making money. That's not acceptable. So you lose your job then. So I always track economic cycles. And when jobless claims break, I think everything changes for the U.S. economy. We're not there yet, right? Jobless claims are still historically low.
You think that could shift in the next couple years?
Each economic cycle is unique. But the longer the Fed stays in restrictive policy, the higher the odds of a policy error. Yeah. And that creates a job loss recession and the earnings go down. People have to get laid off.
And I kind of feel like, and this is just something that I've sensed or I've heard, you know, from different articles, is that there's a lot of cash still sitting on the sidelines in like these
businesses. $6 trillion of cash.
And they just, are they waiting till the Fed just starts cutting, or like what's
well, that? You know, I mean, for a while there, when everyone thought we're going into recession, a lot of CFOs and companies were like, okay, we're not deploying this capital. You know, so they're starting to feel a little bit better about that. So you might get some deployment. The government has deployed a lot of cash. There's a lot of projects that are about to go on work. So I still think that money just keeps on building. Yeah. So I think one thing that I've had to explain to people, that short-term rates going up for some companies is beneficiary. Mm-hmm. They've already borrowed. Let's say a company borrows $2 billion, you know, at a very low rates 5 years ago. They don't have to refinance or anything for another 5 years. But because rates have gone up, short-term rates have gone up, they earn more money on their interest.
Right.
So in a sense,
more arbitrage there.
Yeah, they're actually making more. So some companies are in a better position because the cash they have is earning them more. And, you know, in some cases, that's a big driver of their income for the quarter.
Right.
So we're at that stage. If every company had to refinance their debt today, it's different. But we're still not there yet where that's a big enough, you know, data pool yet where companies have to take on new debt at higher rates yet.
And at that same point, the U.S. government's borrowed a ton of money and our interest rates are going up. So that's going to kick in, you know, that interest payments is going to be so much. I mean, how much is that affecting?
We are going to go to, even before COVID, I think I wrote this article in 2019, we're going to $71 trillion in debt by 2060. I've run
71 trillion.
Yeah. And this is before COVID. So I was like, I've run every single model. There's no way we can't get to 71 trillion in 20, just because the baby boomers are Medicare, Social Security, yeah. Right? The mandatory payouts are so high now. It's that when you have any recession, it's going to create a bigger deficit, more interest on mandatory payments. Then COVID happened, very fast recovery. Lots of revenue that the government has, but it still doesn't matter. The laws of math win at the end.
Yeah.
We have too many older people. We have not enough younger people, so we can't offset it in incomes or taxes.
Will our GDP grow to kind of offset that?
I mean, our GDP will grow. It really depends on how much our labor force grows. You know, there's a recent immigration number. There's 3.8 million people coming to the U.S. Most of that is through immigration. So that will help be, you know, they will produce more for the country working. So at that light, GDP can grow, but we have limits on what we can do even with GDP. For a mature economy of our age, it's harder for mature economies because they're not building new cities or building new things. So that's where GDP has limits on what it can do.
So those interest payments, though, let's talk about that. So with the higher bond, you know, prices, the amount of money that we're printing and to get to 70 trillion, that's going to be a massive portion of our budget.
Yeah, right? It is. And it's going to be, and
this is going to put pressure to reduce rates, right?
I mean,
or keep rates low.
The Fed will do price stability over that. But over time, that's one of the variables, that rates will come down. Short-term rates go down. I don't believe the Fed looks at it as a primary one.
Yeah,
but it's something in general everyone knows. The Fed cares more about, you know, what they're dealing with inflation now. And we just don't, there's literally no, I've run every single model. There's no way to stop this debt train. In fact, I used to say it was 2024 to 2057. That's when the debt baby gets born. Mm. Because that's when really Medicare and Social Security payouts, and every year that if revenue, we have a recession, that means more deficit spending because less revenue. So there's nothing we can do about that. But I always tell people this, wait till China, Japan, or Europe has debt blowups first before us. Like, they the most wealthiest country in the world. We have the biggest military. We have friendly neighbors. We have two oceans. We have things that other countries don't have. So wait for other smaller economies to have a debt blowup that...
Like kind of Greece did.
Kind of to that nature. Then we can maybe talk about here, but here it's not the case.
Yeah. Well, we're in an election year, right? Nothing crazy's happened yet. Not that, you know, anything crazy will happen, but, you know, looking at the last election year, it was pretty nuts. What are your thoughts on this year? Anything predictive that you got in here?
I mean, first of all, anything can happen. Yeah. I always say politics is the word itself, politics, many blood-sucking parasites. So it's just, you know, we don't know how crazy it could get this time, but a lot of confusion can push rates up or down.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people said to me, well, when last time Trump won, mortgage rates went up. Well, the 10-year yield was at 160. And really, when Trump won, they thought economic growth is coming. So I would say mortgage rates move off the macro data. So people just got ahead of that. Mm-hmm. It's not the same case here. We're working from higher rates. We have actually a sticky inflation to work with. So don't put all your eggs on whoever wins the election. Things are going to change too much. They've got to take the Congress, the House, the Senate, and the White House before we could start talking about material changes to the U.S. economy.
Yeah. So you don't think there's nothing you have in your up your sleeve that you think is going to happen? A prediction?
No, I mean, to me, it's there's going to be a lot of noise, a lot of drama, but focused on jobless claims. If jobless claims were running at 323,000, the 10-year yield is mortgage rates are under 6% already.
Yeah.
So we're not there yet. That's the more important story for everyone.
So where do you think we are rate-wise come, say, July?
If jobless claims stay low and the economy is expanding, rates will still hover around here. To me, I've always thought that it's not inflation. If I used inflation as the biggest driver of this, then mortgage rates should be sub 6%. We have bad spreads and the economic data staying firm, and we have one Fed member basically saying we need to hike rates. We should not, you know. So in that environment, rates can't move too much. But if the economy slows down, if jobless claims start to rise, that's how you get sub 6%, even sub 5% mortgage rates.
Right, definitely. Biggest challenge the U.S. is facing right now?
I think uncertainty on policy going out in the future, but eventually in time, demographics hit us. You know, we have a lot of parts of the U.S. that don't have a lot of young people living there. Mm. You know, as their boomers, workers retire, they need to be replaced and need more consumers. And I think that's the thing. You need replacement workers and replacement consumers for the ones that are dying off.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the immigration policies we got now?
Well, immigration had made a huge comeback, and that's one of the reasons why the labor force growth and jobs data was getting better. So in that context, one of the data lines I saw is that, you know, we were almost at 3.8 million immigration coming in, and that explains the population growth being better this year. You're going to have to get them assimilated in terms of getting people into jobs and being productive. Right. And that's a positive for the U.S. If you don't get them assimilated or into the workforce, you know, it becomes a drag. So I think, you know, we see that where they just get in, get a job, start working, paying taxes, send the money home. You know, that's what a lot of times happens. But in this case, population growth has been slowing here for some time. So we need more replacement workers because every single day, baby boomers are leaving.
Yep. Talk to me about advice for mortgage brokers. Well, if you were a mortgage broker right now, because you escaped out of it, but you used to be, what would you tell mortgage brokers to do, you know, in this rate environment, you know?
Focus on the things you can control on.
Yeah.
And I would say getting people pre-qualified, but getting pre-qualified with the right message. Yep. Don't ever talk about mortgage rates. Talk about the payment.
Yep.
And just hammer down the payments are this here, this here, this here, this here. So once they find something they like, they won't lose it, right? Because everyone's kind of thinking, I'll just wait till rates fall and I'll be the only person in the world that'll think that. And all of a sudden, here we are, rates are falling, you know. So get your clients pre-qualified, get them updated, keep them updated to the market. I think one of our reasons our podcast has been so popular is that we really talk about the market and economic data and what can move the market up or down. And I think that's going to be the key for mortgage brokers, is to connect with your clients so they know you're their person, right? Yep, yep. And going in the future, that'll help out whenever rates do fall.
Absolutely. That's good stuff. So where does someone find you? I know the Housing Wire, you're on Instagram. Where else? Like, tell us your tags.
You know, just my name, Logan Moshami. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook or Twitter. Twitter is where the war happens. Instagram stories is really for nerds, because I go over all macroeconomic data. Housing Wire is the website that I write for. We have a Housing Wire tracker, which tracks all the weekly data, freshest data we have. Active listings, new listings, price cut percentages, purchase application data, where the 10 years old. We give that information so everyone can be versed to the most up-to-date data. And, you know, our Housing Wire podcast, you know, you could go on Apple daily. Sarah and I talk about twice a week. We also have a YouTube channel, and both of our podcasts will be there. So again, we try to keep it. You know, I would say economics done right.
Yep.
You know, it's boring. It's not designed to be this hot, fun, sexy thing. But if you always want to be the detective, not the troll, my job is to teach and make economics as fun as possible so you get more people reading. And the podcast, especially the YouTube, it's, you know, it's designed to be very entertaining, but very informative in a way that everybody can understand.
Any funny stories about Twitter trolls? Probably have a bunch.
God, you know, I think the... One of the things I always remember is during COVID, right when COVID happened, I had all these messages like, ha ha, the US is going to collapse. I was like these people are crazy. Like there's some men who will literally give up their whole lives if they see a 1929 or 1987 or 2008 event. They're just like, you know, usually these people are the people that hate the Federal Reserve. And it's just like very hard for them to like live in America after 1913. And it's just like the world isn't collapsing, and just, it's frustrating. But I remember all these people just like bombarding me about, here it is. It's like, here's like, we literally, our people are dying, and all they care about is how home prices are going to crash. Yeah. And
like, haha, you're wrong.
Yeah. So I kept everything. I kept 12. Oh my God. People don't like when I go after the housing crash people, I literally list all the things in every single year since 2012. I would say they're the broken clock theory. So what people don't understand is that I know who these people are. And since you keep everything, this is where you get the live debates. And then all of a sudden when they say, hey, yeah, yeah, I said, no. Remember you in 2013? You remember what you said here? You remember this? Oh yeah, here's a screenshot of this. Oh, you remember you were the housing crash person in, you know, December
2016.
Yeah, so we are just, we constantly do this, because now I figured out how to really go after these people. Is get them into camera debates, and it's just it's a crucible. It'll be such a takedown. But if everybody sees them, they go, my God, these people really are frauds. They're not housing people. They're not, there's no
like fear porn, right?
There's no forecasting. There's no models. There's no nothing. So the best way is that keeping everything, and God, my iPhone has so much stuff stored in it. And
screenshots.
Yeah. Screenshots. and they don't know. I use their own languages against them. And then sometimes I'll show them, hey, remember this? This is you. They're like, you know, so I would say 90% of the trolling people have gone away because they know what I'm doing. I'm baiting them into live debates.
Yep.
But my job for the next 10 years is to go on as many live debates with all the crazy YouTube, TikToks, Instagram, Twitter, whatever, and destroy as many of them as possible. Because I know for sure is that these people don't forecast and they don't model, so they can't. And you just ask them for their forecast and they go, I don't do that. Of course I know you don't do that. I just want everyone else to know that, you know? And then, you know, there's going to be a time where we have a recession. Like, I'm big on economic cycles, recession recovery models. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to teach people how to do this, and they'll know. But when the recession happens, they always are too late on the recovery. And that's always the case. And they never let it go. And this is how they've, you know, a lot of these people make their livings on YouTube is doing this. So I think, go after everyone, hunt them down piece by piece, right? But in this, Like I always tell people, I'm that old guy 700 years ago that is sitting in a dungeon with a candle looking at scrolls. Like that's me now.
Yeah.
I'm a pilgrim in an unholy land now. Now it's everything is, you know, out in the open, but I have to adapt to the world we in. And this is why the theatrics come in now. We're challenging people and making fun and kind of making economics funny in the sense, and then keeping people entertained enough to learn.
Yep.
And a lot of the housing crash people actually ended up learning from me. Because what happened this year is a lot of them just, you know, they just zipped. Mm. I mean, they were just when the 10-year yield started to go lower and they were like, you know, so so in a way, the funny story is that I taught the crazy people how to read economic data correctly because there was a big quiet period, which I never get. I get bombarded every single day. And after when rates started to fall again, there was such a silence. It was just like golden for me because I realized they read. Reading mm-hmm. is a good thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
is there going to be recession?
There's always recessions. Economic cycles come and
like
go.
Like next year, maybe?
I mean, to me, it's I always tell people that I understand why everyone went into the 100% recession crowd because of what happened in 2022. We forget. Europe was going to freeze to death. Right?
Yeah, no.
Oil went up. The Fed was hiking rates like crazy and the housing market data started to crash. So housing leads the recession. That's what all the Wall Street firms. So except November 9th came. And to me, it's like I'm a 10-year yield guy. I got to channel bond markets and everything. I said, okay, for now, the 10-year yield's peaked. The next move is going to be lower. Not because the Fed's cutting rates or anything. It said that there's so much world drama. Money's going to go into the bond market. If this happens and the housing data starts to recover, this changes everything.
Yeah.
And I say, nobody's going to believe me November 9th. I say, I get it. But we're going to have this tracker data. When this comes out every single week, everyone's going to see this. They could visually see the forward-looking data getting better. And 6-7 months from now, when home prices are, you know, they're not crashing anymore, then at least everyone has this idea about, okay, how to read data correctly. Guess what happened? Rates went down, home sales stopped crashing. It's really rare in America to get home sales under 4 million monthly. And the builders recovered, you know, the builders' mm-hmm. confidence. So everyone's Wall Street's model failed right in front of them. And by it was 6 or 7 months into 2023, it was too late for them. They couldn't give it up.
Yeah.
You almost have to double or triple down. So I always tell people this, residential construction workers fall first. Because they get hit by rates harder than anyone else.
Right.
So when rates go down, they're benefited more than anyone else. Residential construction workers didn't fall this time. This is if you want your last recession indicator, this is it. And so far it's still holding up. So wait for the final data lines, jobless claims to rise, residential, then you got something. It might be 7 years, might be 7 months, but don't jump the gun like a lot of people do. And then all of a sudden, they've got to double down on a bad recession call or triple down. And here we are today. I think the real clever people are saying, hey, they need to raise rates more because the economy is booming. What they really want is rates to go high enough to break something.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's a cheaper house.
Yeah. So it's just that act only works on the uninitiated. So.
Well, if I handed you $1 million right now, what would you do with it? Would you invest it in housing? Would you invest in the bond market? Where would you put it?
Where would I? Okay, so if I had $1 million.
Cash.
Okay, so I could get 5% on a CD. I could put a quarter into the S&P, a quarter into the bond market fund. I'd get a CD, and then I would actually...
You'd sit on some cash.
Huh? No, yeah. I wouldn't sit on the cash.
Well, in a CD.
I would actually look to buy a distressed property.
Okay.
You know, something that is just these vacant homes that nobody wants.
Right.
You know, ugly. Fix it up. And then the cash flow is there. In this way, you have two cash flow flowing incidents and you have your hedge bond market and then the S&P 500, which, you know, for the first time, you know, that the 60-40 model didn't work because bonds had a really terrible year in the S&P. But this way you're covered and your portfolio is somewhat hedged out and then you could take advantage in case one of the sectors are really getting hit in that. That's how I would hedge the $1 million.
We're not giving financial advice, yeah. guys, but that's an interesting take. You know, you put some of it in real estate and some of it in hedging and into some
bonds and stocks and real estate, and then actually just really distressed vacant properties, which are still they're out there.
They may be hard to find, but
they're hard to find, and nobody likes to do the work. And you know, but
the construction workers are busy. So
yeah,
it's hard to get the good ones, right?
It's hard to get the good ones. So, but yeah, you could do something like that where you're properly balanced, properly hedged.
Yep. Well, any shout outs you have for anyone's helped you along the way?
Shout out to Sarah Wheeler, my partner on my podcast, who always reins me in. I always say, you know, this Unleash Logan, and she goes, no, nobody can listen to you when you go back and forth and all that. So, Sarah and Clayton Housing Wire. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't sign that contract with them late 2019. And thank you for allowing that COVID-19 recovery model to go in there. And it's been a lot of fun, and it's just starting. Yeah. That's the most exciting part about it. This phase of my life is just starting. And we go our nerd tours all the time. And shout out to Caroline, who's my marketing person who helps me organize everything. So the Housing Wire crew out there, definitely, because it's a lot of work. I don't sleep much. I'm up all the time, you know, and it's a kind of a one man show in that regard. So, thanks to Housing Wire and everyone who works there.
That's awesome. Well, I do get a lot out of Housing Wire. If you're listening, definitely check it out. If you want to be in the know, follow Logan. He's a wealth of information. And thanks for listening to this podcast. Please like, share, subscribe, check out Logan's stuff, follow him, and then you'll be in the know as well. See you on the next podcast. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
All right. See ya.
The $1 million Mortgage Experience Podcast.